Let me get a lay of the land as we are getting started. We're right at time, but I want to give people a chance to move in here. How many are lead pastors in some lead pastor role? Let me see your hands. I always like to know who I'm speaking to. I can kind of slant the direction of what we're talking about. Can you hear me okay if I just talk this way? I don't like standing behind a single place talking. I know there's amplification there, but I think I can project if that's all right. How many are student pastors or student leaders? You might be leading, but you're not a pastor, but you occupy that role. How about children's areas? How about family ministry? How about worship? Worship, see some of you. Okay, good. Excellent. I have zero ability in that, so I can't help you a bit, okay? That's not what we're going to talk about. You can leave. You will not hurt my feelings, okay? How about executive pastors? Any executive pastors? How about this? How about you teach some age group on a weekly basis, okay? Shout out. I just want to hear, what age group do you teach? Shout it all at once. I can kind of get an idea. Okay, senior adults. I'm hearing mostly adults. Anybody doing teens? Teens, okay. Children? Okay, some children. Good. All the way across the board here. Great. It's funny. Where did I see Lynn? Lynn, where are you? I'm not going to pick on. He and I were talking this morning. I'm going to pick on me, okay? It's time to reverse this role for a minute. I've got a session this afternoon that I submitted. This kind of a bit of a newer topic that I'm taking some of my other content, rolling into it and repositioning it. And I submitted it as the title and a description. And somewhere along the way, the description didn't make it to all the publications. So I've got this session this afternoon called I'm Done Losing. How many people you think are going to show up admitting they're losing and wanting to? I'm like, there's going to be nobody in here this afternoon, but we're going to talk through the major problems. And some of this is all related. If you've heard me talk, you know my heartbeat is two areas. I will spend time talking about leadership, and I'll spend time talking about discipleship. And I believe they're two siblings in the same family because they're defined very similarly. So I do need to rush to get through this. This is a new talk that I developed this year, and it's packed. I'm just going to warn you, it's packed. I did it when I was asked to go to a Missouri youth ministers retreat where multiple people attended, and Ryan Akers invited me to speak in there, and I put this together, and you may recognize a part of it because I also wrote an article in one magazine talking about one part of it. But I really do think this encompasses some of the big nuggets that we need to understand. But to do so, I'm going to get started in here, and we'll jump through it. What are the curious questions? Some of you said you teach children. What are the odd questions kids ask? Let's just toss out a couple. Like when you're in there and you're doing prayer requests or you're asking the application to a message or a teaching or whatever it is, what are those curious questions they ask? Give me one that you've heard recently.
Who made God?
Who made God? That's a good one. Yeah. You know, one of the most odd ones whenever I think about it, I was teaching in a children's church setting early in my ministry. I was on staff. And I was in the church, and little James, who was about 6 years old, I was right at the point at the end of the message where it was getting serious, and I was asking them to think through what they're going to do with it, you know, not an invitation, but kind of that internal invitation. And I'm trying to keep, and James has got his hand up just doing this, and he's up front, so everybody's seeing him doing this, waving his hand, trying to get my attention. I'm trying really hard to move on because I never know what's going to come out of James's mouth, okay? Finally, I just knew I couldn't ignore him because everybody's like, James is wiggling. You know, he's all over. I said, James, what is it? He said, Mr. Ron, did you know you got all your hair standing up straight on top of your head? I'm like, that has nothing to do with the lesson. Kids do. They ask the most odd questions. Here's the neat part about it. We all have questions, but we've lost the childlike heart and we stop asking them out loud. When we face the pain points that we've faced in the last 2 years, I've had a ton of questions. God, why is this happening? How are we going to survive? Why are these people not here? Where is the landscape shifting? We're seeing a lot of questions being asked. And if we're honest as leaders, we're asking them too. We just don't want to ask them out loud. We don't want to be that vulnerable in front of other people. But I'm going to tell you, if we don't start addressing these types of questions, it's going to be the end of us as a movement. It'll never be the end of Christianity because Christianity is going to survive. We know that. But God's not promised our movement. I want our movement to survive. I want our churches to survive and thrive. So let's kind of jump into the why in all of this. And the why is important. If I could, from a leadership discipleship standpoint, hammer one takeaway into everybody's mind, I would say you need to know why you do what you do more than what you do. The what you can do can change, and it has over time. I mean, many of you are now using PowerPoint and messages, and 20 years ago you did not. Some of you may have instruments on your main stage you didn't have 20 years ago. You might have been against some of these things 20 years ago. But they're methods, they're the what. But our why should never change. It's our mission, it's our purpose. And so I want us to think through the difference, because if I can help you understand the why, then your what will always be good. I wish I could give you the attribution. I heard this a long time ago. It's not original with me. It came through a friend who attributed it to the original source. But he said, methods are many, principles are few, methods may change, but principles never do. We need to drive a stake in the ground on principles. But our methods may change as long as they meet our principles, okay? So when we decide we're going to change a program, or we're going to change a curriculum, or we're going to change an activity, or we're going to change any event at our church, we need to ask why first, not what. Not what will it do. It's not totally pragmatic, so we start with why. Now, let's introduce some statistics and some observations. Some of these you're going to absolutely recognize. Some of them may be new to you, okay? Let's start with the first one. Does anybody know what this number represents? 64%. This is about an 18-month-old piece of research. It used to be just over half, by the way. And I've had to change my slides this year, and especially as I teach. I teach family ministry and youth ministry at two different universities, and I update my research on a regular basis, and I've just updated all of this to 64%. Anyone know what this number represents? Yes.
Teenagers at the high school.
Correct. And I would say it happens prior. It's actually prior. It starts around middle school and goes on up, but it is teenagers that drop out of church. They will walk away from their faith. And the scary part is the statistics will also say only half of them will return. Now, that may sound daunting to you. And the way I usually like to do this is I kind of size up the room. And we do kind of look like we're half and half. Do you agree with that? We're kind of half and half in this room. So I would come over to the room and I would say, I tell you what, I'm gonna do it kind of in an angle here. The gentleman in the back in the maroon shirt, stay seated. You in the white shirt, stay seated. But from here over, everybody stand. If this room represented the number of young people in your church, the people standing are going to leave church, leave the faith. Now, from here back, sit down. They will return most likely at some point later in their life. You guys sat down, but this group will not, that you still see standing. They're going to stay away from church for the remainder of their lives. That's what research shows. And if I were in your shoes and I were a parent, I would say this is not acceptable, and this is the stat we've got to change. We want people to fall in love with Jesus Christ and stay in love with Him their entire lives. Thank you. You may be seated. Let's go to the next one. Biblical worldview. The reason why they walk away is because they don't have biblical worldviews instilled in them. They don't have the answers for these questions they're asking. Where did God come from? Is the Bible real? Did He create it? Why does He allow Russia to attack Ukraine? Why are there innocent people dying? They have real life issues. Why is COVID just attacking in such a way indiscriminately? They have lots of questions. And usually we try to pacify them with easy human answers, not biblical answers. We've got to get biblical worldview in this. Faith deconstruction. Are you familiar with this term, faith deconstruction? If you're not, Google it. Start reading some Christian articles on faith deconstruction. This is happening even if you're not familiar with the term. People are unpacking their faith and picking it apart, and they're, again, using this to walk away. There are some notable major ministry leaders' children's who are in the news in faith deconstruction. You will be shocked and surprised to see how this is happening. And while they're in the news, it's happening in your church. It is occurring. Gender identity. God created man and he created woman. It is a binary. It is an either or. But yet we're struggling with identity with our kids, and the culture, the media, school, everything around them is trying to show that it's acceptable to put more sliding scales and generic scales, or to move back and not identify either way. We've got to biblically show how God has provided that unique way that man and woman is exactly who he wanted us to be, and it's a beautiful thing. But they're struggling with it. And it comes back again from biblical literacy. Biblical literacy and biblical worldview are very tied. You know why our kids are struggling with biblical literacy? Want to guess? Because their parents are struggling with biblical literacy. And I'll get to the why in just a moment on how this is unpacked, but these are issues. Truth versus truth with a capital T. And keep on going. 1 over 168, I'll unpack here in a minute. But how many of you love numbers in here? How many of you love math? You're a math. You guys are sick puppies. Put your hands down. Okay, that's. How many love words? You love words. I'm a words person, okay? My son is an engineer. He loves numbers. He can get over my head really quick. But I'm a words person. So for all of you numbers people who, you know, are more brilliant than the rest of us in the room, is 1 over 168 a big number or a small number? Small number. So if I rolled a chocolate cake out in here into the middle of the room and I handed you the knife and said, please slice me a 1 over 168, there's 168 people in this room, slice everybody a slice of cake, how could you do it? That would be tough, wouldn't it? Be very, very hard. And if you got served one of those slices of cake, you'd feel as insulted as some of the banquets we've been to at this convention so far, wouldn't you? I jest. They're doing their best. They're doing their best. That is a tiny number. But I'll show you in a minute that one represents the number of hours that the average person gets in discipleship each week, and the 168 are the number of hours in a week, and how that breaks down, okay? Prodigals, big, big deal. Let's connect this. We connected biblical literacy and biblical worldview, but let's connect prodigals to the 64%. If 64% of kids walk away from the church, how much of a percentage of parents in your church are suffering with prodigals? 64%. Yeah, it's not a really hard question, is it? We just had everybody stand in here representing that. Now I need you to think about standing in front of your congregation this Sunday and realizing almost two-thirds of your congregation have at least one prodigal in their family. And they are suffering silently with that one. They are mourning. If it would be their number one request, they would ask every time, pray for so-and-so. You know why? Number one, it breaks their heart. Their son or daughter is not in church. Oftentimes struggling with a gender identity issue. It's one of the top ones they deal with. And number two, they're watching their grandkids grow up not in church and don't know how to fix it. That is a big, big deal, prodigals. So if we start with why, then I want us to understand the difference in the categories we have on the left and the right up here. On the left, the why deals with our vision, our mission, our philosophy, our principles, our guidelines, our destination. The how or the what is related. Strategy is not the why. Programs are not the why. Activities are not the why. Details are not the guidelines. The means to get there is not the destination. Okay? We have Chaplain Dodson up here. One of the things the military is really good at is logistics. They are brilliant at moving major, major items long distances and supporting them. If you want to read something interesting, go back and read about the Revolutionary War and how Washington had to carry out battles, feeding the troops, keeping them healthy, dealing with the winter. I mean, these are things that the military just today naturally does brilliantly. Okay? So you think, well, they do. Pastors, you do it well too. It's just called VBS. It's called youth camp. There's all these other terms we have. We shuttle people over there. We make sure they get fed. We make sure they're healthy. We make sure they have policies. Okay, so let's use one of these for example. Let's say that we're going to go do, and our church has at times done VBSs in Ecuador, okay? So let's pretend we're going to go to Ecuador and put on a VBS for, they call them the Jungle Kids down in Ecuador. How will we get there? What are you thinking? We're going to take 30 young people down to Ecuador for 10 days and do ministry. How are we going to get there? Plane? I heard plane. I heard flight. That's one way. How else could we get there? Boat? Good. How else could we get there? Car? Be a long drive, but we could get there by car. We could get there by horse and buggy. I know nobody's going to suggest that, but horse and buggy is an option. Submarine is an option. Hot air balloon is. In other words, these are means to get there, and they sound absurd. But I'm going to tell you, so many times as ministry leaders, we get hung up on the means without the why. The why is going and doing ministry. The means is kind of irrelevant. The means is determined by your budget. It may be determined by how many kids, what's the gender, what's the mixed gender, how many chaperones do you have? Don't get hung up on the what, get hung up on the why. Now, I'm a big fan of reading some books that are not always Christian, and Simon Sinek would certainly fit that category. So I don't want to stand before you and say, hey, this is, but he is a great business mind, he's a creative mind, and he has some great sayings along this. He said, vision is a destination, a fixed point we focus all effort, but strategy's the route, like we just talked about with the VBS. An adaptable path to get us where we want to go. Now, learning from him is a really good thing. It just dawned on me. Hang on. It just dawned on me. I have a video and sound, but no sound. Give me a second. This is worthy of us plugging in somehow. Give me a second, I'll get it turned up. The King or the Wright brothers, they all think, act, and communicate the exact same way. This is a lesson in how not to do a presentation really quickly here. Normally, I'm right on. I rarely play videos in my sessions, but I wanted you to hear his words. So I'm going to come out, come back into this one, and I'm going to get my sound turned up before I get there. Funny thing is, you can see sound, and I'm still looking for it. Thank you. Thank you. There we go. Sound. I'm going to turn it all the way up. MacBook Pro speakers. Display port. Let's try. As it turns out, all the great and it's. We're going to skip the video. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to tell you to go Google Simon Sinek afterwards, starts with why. It is one of the most watched TED Talks you will encounter. It's a bit older and you can tell it, but there's a wow factor when you watch it. He's going to talk through terms like the Wright brothers, how they, underfunded, less logistically capable, they outperformed somebody else who was working from the Smithsonian who conquered flight before anyone else did. He's going to talk about how Apple computers turned the computer world upside down by saying they started with the why, not the what. Don't come buy our cute computers. Come buy it because we make computing very different. We think different. He goes back to Martin Luther King and he says, Martin Luther King didn't come to the stage and say, hey, I have a plan. He said, I have a dream. He started with the why. And that's what we've got to do in Christ in what we're doing. I'll give you another example. If you went to the doctor and the doctor says, okay, by the way, my doctor's done this to me. I went to him. I said, doc, my knee hurts. And he's like, yep. He said, what do you want me to do about it? I said, do you have any medicine for it or something kind of help to this or maybe something you can tell me to kind of get past this? He says, yeah, you can lose 20 pounds. I'm like, is there an option B? I'm like, option A is work, you know? And I felt really bad. You know, I'm like, and he's like, no, he said, that's really what you need to do. And so, you know, you begin to think about, okay, I could do plan A, cardio, sports, and weight loss, or I can do plan B, weight training, nutrition, and supplements. Now, what's missing from up there? What's on the clipboard? Is it a why or is it a what? Let's start there. It's a little in between, but it's more of a why, but it's not gotten so specific with the what. For example, in cardio, it's a category. What could I do in cardio? A treadmill. I hate treadmills. Yeah, I like ellipticals more than treadmills, but you know, if I'm going to pick one. I could walk outside, but it's hot where I live. I can find every excuse in the world not to do what I'm about to talk about here. So these are the what's, but the weight loss is the why, and the cardio is just a category, okay? I want you to start thinking in those terms. Here's why we do what we do. Here's some categories, and not get hung up on the what's, okay? If you're getting this, we're good, and we're going to keep moving, okay? So that's where we get, and oftentimes if I was teaching at a off-site retreat, I'd actually give you some homework assignment, and we come back the next day, and we debrief over it. But I want you to do this on your own. I want you to look at your vision mission statement and see if it describes more what, or does it describe more why? Is it more detailed than it should be? You need one overarching says, this is what we're about. Now you can support it with your strategy with some bullet points underneath it. But that overarching should be something that should stand a little more test of time. So all organizations, this is another Simon Sinek quote, all organizations start with why, but only the great ones keep the why clear year after year. Now, let's define discipleship for just a moment. How would you define discipleship? There are multiple ways. And by the way, this is not a trick question. If I can quote Avalio, he said that when you define leadership, it's defined by as many ways as the people who define it itself. I think discipleship could probably fit that category, but there'd be a lot of commonality. So how would you define it? Not a trick question. Let's just toss these out.
Process of developing healthy followers of Christ.
Good. Process of help developing. I'm going to repeat because we're recording. Process of developing healthy followers for Christ. What else? Yes. Train people in the way God wants them to live. That's really good.
Bringing people to Christ and helping them grow.
Bringing people to Christ and helping them grow. Good. What else? These are all good. Probably you're sitting there going, yeah, they pretty much said it. I just nuance it slightly different. So I'm going to throw up on the screen my working definition, but I'm going to tell you, just like my definition of leadership, I keep revisiting this and tweaking it a little bit, but it doesn't change dramatically, okay? This is my current working definition of discipleship, okay? Biblically, and I'll actually give the passages that I take it from, it means passionately finding, pursuing, and living for Christ while helping others, all generations and ethnicities, do the same, which involves both reaching and teaching at church and at home, okay? Actually, I have another version of this as I'm reading this. I don't always update every version. But one of the items I really like putting into disciple making is making disciple makers. It's not in this one, I'm just noticing. Making disciple makers. Because if we're just teaching people to be more mature, that sounds like we're only self-focused. Discipleship is not a teach only. It's a reach and teach. There used to be a great debate 10, 20 years ago. Does your church do evangelistically better or do they do discipleship better? And truthfully, our churches tend to fit in one of those two categories. And sadly, the Bible does not exempt us from either of the sides. We're to be reaching people who will teach them to be mature and do all the things we talked about, but part of that means replicating ourselves and going out and making more disciples. So, the what characteristics matter, okay? Let's kind of look at this. The larger stickability results, this is what I'm about to walk you through. This is what changes the stats that we showed at the beginning. The 64%, the prodigals, the biblical literacy, the biblical worldview, all of those items on these screens. These four items I'm about to share with you is the solution. So we've been talking through the problems, getting us in the right mindset. But the very first one that shows stickability is Bible engagement. Now, Bible engagement happens really well at church. We're in a day right now that in the history of the church, we have probably not had better trained pastors and staff members than what we do right now, ever in the history of the church. We have student ministers and we have children's ministers who have master's degrees, MDivs, they're seminary trained, they're going on to graduate programs. Our own Free Will Baptist colleges are offering more and more graduate programs. We have some of the very best trained people coming out that we've ever had. And I'm excited about it. But sometimes that's intimidating to our parents who think, you know what? You know more than I know. I'm going to make sure you disciple my kids while they're at church. And they step away. And they expect the teachers, the life group leaders, the student pastor, the lead pastor. Yeah, discipleship happens only at church. And that's that 1 over 168 problem that we faced earlier. If we're only going to be discipled for an hour a week, how many of you cheer for a sport team? Any sporting team? Let me hear who it is.
Cowboys,
Packers,
Auburn,
Alabama. I'm sorry I repeated that one. No, I'm kidding. I'm picking on Alan, my friend back there. If you're a serious fan, you probably know who plays. You even know what the recruits look like for upcoming seasons, who's been selected, drafted, who are the blue chip, and I don't even know all the terminology for all this, okay? But you know these items. You follow the stats. Could you be a fan 1 hour a week during sporting season? You can't even watch an entire game in 1 hour a week. Then why do we give less to God? So when I talk about Bible engagement and the research talks about Bible engagement, it means daily. Doesn't mean just at church. Pastors, let me talk to you for a moment. If I were to go and poll your people on Tuesday, and I ask them this question, what did your pastor preach about? Out of 100 people I would ask, how many people could tell me the major takeaway you intended them to get? I don't know. It's indicting, to say the least. We love it in the moment, but we're so quick to walk away from it. So we need to build in ways to remind them what you preach through the week. What is taught in Sunday school and life group, we need to build in ways to remind them what was taught. And we've got to do that better than we've ever done it before. So Bible engagement's a very important item. And so what we found is if we can get kids and teenagers reading their Bible more consistently. In fact, I don't have this on the screen, but we put out something just pre-COVID that I think was somewhat divine and prophetic for where we are. It's called a chart, Measure What Matters. I think it's past the day that we're measuring attendance and offering as the sole measurement of our congregations and our life groups in Sunday school. What we should be measuring is how many times a week were they in the Bible? How many of them shared their faith with a classmate, family member, or someone else? We need to be, if we raise the expectation that you're supposed to be evangelistic, they will do it. People respect what you inspect. And so we asked the question, how many times did you read the Bible? How many times did you, did you share your faith? We just asked, did you share it once in there? Are you here? Yes, we did do attendance in there. But we believe the measures of sharing one's faith and being in the Word of God are far more important than those 5 to 7 things we used to measure on the little envelopes when I was growing up in Sunday school. Okay? So Bible engagement is the first one. The second one is sharing one's faith. I've just alluded to that in the Measure What Matters. But here's what's going to happen here for the most part, okay? If I were, Chris, can I borrow you for a minute?
Absolutely.
Let's say Chris heads off to school, okay? He's a teenage boy. He heads off to school. He's excited about what the pastor preached. And Chris shares with his classmates, his friends, hey, let me tell you about what my pastor preached about. Let me tell you about what I learned in Sunday school yesterday, life group, whatever he's calling it. If he cares about his friends, he's going to share his faith, okay? And he is. He's excited about Christ. But here's what his friends is going to do. Yeah, why do you go to church, Chris? Why do you know the Bible's true? Chris, how can you explain why my aunt died of COVID? He's going to get those kinds of questions. What is that going to drive him back to do? Get back in his Bible with Bible engagement. He's going to call us, Chris, to come back and ask his lead pastor or a student pastor or a Sunday school teacher or life group leader, say, you know what, I'm getting these questions I don't know how to answer. Now we're getting mentoring going, which is actually going to be number four. Okay, we'll get to that one in a moment. But it's cyclical. Bible engagement, sharing one's faith, they reinforce each other. And then we get to volunteering in church. When we can get kids and teenagers doing activities in the church. I was just in Mark's church 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago. There were kids singing. There were kids receiving the offering. These are little things. But the more they get to participate, the more they belong, they don't attend. We want our kids to belong. We want them to own. This is my church. It's not, oh, I attend a church. No, this I'm proud of where I go. And by the way, I've seen some of your PowerPoints. And by the way, this is my worst. I'm more embarrassed with this PowerPoint than any other one I did. And I actually did this one earlier this year. I must have been a bad week or something. I think it's my most boring PowerPoint. But I've seen some of our PowerPoints. We could use the teenagers in our church to build our slide decks for us. We could use our teenagers to run our sound. That's one of the things our church did really well when my son was a teenager. They plugged him into running sound in the youth group and in other places. And so when he moved away as an adult, he wound up doing AV in the church he's in. We need to plug them in early based on their gifts. Some of them will never get out front. They want to be behind the scenes doing something. Put them in charge of stacking chairs, sound, greeting, whatever it is, but let them belong to church. And then number four, a warm, nurturing, and that word nurturing's not there, but a warm, loving adult is involved in the kids' lives. I'm going to give you a name in case you want to go out and read this book, but I'm going to give you the summary, so I'm going to save you about, I think it's about a 16-hour read, so I'm going to save you 16 hours in the next 3 minutes, okay? Vern Bingston. It's an Oxford release, Oxford University Press, and it's about passing along one's faith and what it takes to do so. Vern Bingston is a person that was referred to me by a friend of ours, Sean McDowell, Josh's son. He said, Ron, you need to look at them and have him at D6. And we did. We brought Vern Ben. He spoke about 6 years ago. It's one of the most boring, monotone, level speakers we've ever had at the conference. I'm sitting back in the back of the room going, our people are hating this. This is horrible. And I probably had more people come to me after and say, wow, that was great. He almost read from a manuscript, but here's what he said. He followed the same families. This is what's called in academia a longitudinal study, okay? He followed the exact same families, kept measuring them year after year over how their faith was passed along from one generation to another. And his number one result found an involved, warm, nurturing dad. Now, I changed it to parents. I was in Korea about 6-7 weeks ago. I was talking to parents and pastors, and I asked every dad in the room to stand. Can we model that for just a moment? If you're a dad, doesn't matter what age your kids are, will you stand? Now, I'm going to make a cultural shift here. In Asia, it's a pretty high-performing culture. There's a high expectation of grades. There's a high expectation of becoming an adult and being responsible, not shaming the family. I can go on and on about the cultural side. So what do you think dad's trying to cultivate in that culture? Respect, performance. And so I look the dads in the eye and I read Ephesians chapter 6, verse 1, where God says, dads, bring your kids up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. And I looked at them and said, dads, are you nurturing your kids? Or are you shaming your kids? Dads, are you putting your kids on a performance role? Or are you putting them on a grace expectation of high holiness? I had one dad come to me afterwards with tears in his eyes. He said, you just helped save my 12-year-old son's relationship between he and I. I'm going to let you be seated, but I'm going to give you this thought. How come we parent our kids more harshly than our Heavenly Father parents us? By the way, it's a major. I'm not gonna lay shame, and I'm not gonna lay guilt, because I'm gonna tell you what I've done. I've got some moments I'm embarrassed over. One of them was our son, our firstborn. He was about 9 months, and I don't remember his exact age, but he was still in a high chair. And he was eating his food, but he would throw some over. And I'm like, no. And I was trying to get him to keep his food on the... And at the end of that meal, I'm embarrassed to tell you this. I've apologized to my son, who has no knowledge of remembering what happened. But I took him out of the high chair, and I got down and said, let's pick up this food. And my wife looked at me and said, he's only... And he gave the number of months. And I'm like, but I had this... You know, it was the military in me. But I was down, I was like, we're going to pick this up. You know, and she's like, he's only 9 months old. And I'm like, I got to get over this performance expectation here. Because my Heavenly Father's far more graceful with me than I was with my kids at times. This contributes to sending them into prodigal thoughts. Because if they can't perform at a standard acceptable for mom and dad, they'll find a group of people who will accept them as they are. And I'll leave it there and we can chase that. I've got a whole talk on prodigals. We won't go there. But these are four pieces of research that should inform our strategy. Who do we minister to? Okay? I want you to look at your people, and I want you to ask the question, what are the communities of people God has placed your church in the midst of? Okay? You need to do this. And by the way, let me point the finger back to the executive office. They've got a really good study for a driving radius that you can look, that they've worked with Tom Rainer, and I think it'll give you a good demographic study or a psychographic study for where you are. What are the ages that people have with you? If you are mostly elderly congregation, you're probably going to attract elderly. Or you're going to have to get super creative to start reaching people 5 to 10 years younger and keep building on that over 5 years. It's going to be the only way you break out of that. You should group people by the age of their oldest kids. I don't have time to go deeply into this, but adults with kids in the home love to be around other adults with kids of their oldest child's same age. Say, Ron, what do you mean by that? When our kids were 2 and 3 years old, we wanted to be around other parents who had kids who were 2 and 3 because we couldn't figure out how to do potty training really well. When our kids became 6th and 7th graders, we were debating what's a good time to give them a cell phone. We wanted to ask other parents. And being in a life group with people whose season of life is similar is the way we do community together in Christ. So think about it, not just the age of the parents, but the age of that oldest child is where they're going to be grouping together. Season of life is the one we just talked about. You can group people by needs. So that's where you would get into some areas of elective studies and so forth, whether they're married or unmarried, single again. The one thing we've got to do that God does really well with us is He's a redeeming God. We teach family ministry. But I'm going to tell you, family ministry is not perfect. Not everybody has a single marriage that has been married 30 or 40 years. While God would wish that to be, and we would wish that to be, there are families who have gone through divorce. They've gone through losing a spouse to death. They've gone through losing a spouse to addiction and incarceration. And we need to be a church who can redeem that and show grace, love, and minister to that family, even though they're not the ideal family, without making them feel like they're second rate. Because God can redeem and still use them, even though there may be consequences to some of the choices they've made out there prior. Now, let's look at how church tends to look with communities. We want everybody to come together for worship, okay? Everybody comes together for worship. And hopefully, if you're in a healthy position, and by the way, healthy is going to have to be redefined in post-COVID. I'm just going to say it. Right now, we don't know where these numbers are. So I'm going to give you pre-COVID numbers. And I still think it's a pretty good target for you. Whatever your number is in worship, a healthy church should shoot for between 75 and 80% to be a part of a Sunday school or life group. Okay? That's a good, healthy number to reach and attain. Some of you are probably over that. Some of you are maybe slightly below that. But that's where you should strive. Okay? I find so many people say, well, if I can't get 100%, I'm going to give up on it. You haven't given up on tithing, so don't tell me that for this. Okay? Because I know you don't have 100% people tithing in your church. So out of Sunday school emerges D groups. So Sunday school is usually a subcomponent of worship. D groups is a subcomponent of life groups. yesterday, Kevin and I got a chance to teach on D groups, and really he taught, and I just kind of gave some overview to some other areas, but he did a great one. If you want to pull that audio later, it's really worth listening to his, what they're learning at their church and how they're doing D groups. But D groups, in essence, is probably between 3 and 7 people, same gender, high accountability, stay together for up to a year, asking the hard questions, diving in deep to the Word of God, okay? But it's a closed group. Once they get started, after week 2 or 3, no guests can come into that group because it ruins accountability. And that's what's needed in that group most. Sunday school should always be an open group, the complete opposite. So if you have a class in your church that's teaching through, oh man, sorry, I'm sizing up the room here. I was about to tell an illustration. I'm looking to see if anybody is from that church. I know you've never been there and done that. I kid you not. I hope I don't offend. I don't think anybody's in this room. I was in a church 3 years ago, and I always asked the pastor, what class do you want me to visit? Went to this class. He put me in there. And they had written on the board, whiteboard, the attributes of God. And the teacher stood up and says, well, Brother Ron, we're not teaching from the curriculum. He said, we've been doing our own study, our own thing. He said, we're studying the attributes of God. We're on number 4. And we're 9 months into it. I looked like you did. I lost my poker face, Brother Jeff. I did. I'm like, no guest is ever going to want to come into this class. That's a closed group that they didn't even realize they closed it. That will be a stagnant group. They will not grow. They will just die. Okay? Sunday school is meant to be a time where somebody can enter week 1 and not feel left behind. That's why curriculum is designed the way it is. So if you want to study Beth Moore or Matt Chandler or David Platt or anything else, that's an elective. It's not a Sunday school. Because once you get past week 2, nobody wants to join of that 8-week or 12-week that it's in. So we grab a curriculum that has an intentional scope and sequence to it. And then we have midweek electives, okay? Midweek electives can happen anywhere, and we're going to get into what that looks like, but they all drive to one point, daily life. And if daily life is healthy, then worship becomes healthy and your church becomes healthy. This is cyclical. Now, let's get to these 4 out of the 5 questions, put them all together on one big graph, okay? Why, where, what, and who? Hopefully this puts off all the, this is where this puts off all the alarm bells. You know, when I'm teaching, I can see the students' eyes go, yes, I get it, I get it, I get it. I was sitting in calculus, I never got it, okay? But hopefully this gets you over that hurdle for this area. The why? If we really want to address biblical worldview, biblical literacy, apologetics, and connect to all ages, the best place for it is life group or Sunday school. Whatever your nomenclature, I don't care what you call it, but Sunday morning meeting time is the best place to address foundational issues that's taught for a lifetime. Okay? The who? People of the same age or stage of life. Okay? Where? It's really best at church. I know there's great arguments today over, hey, we want to move to the homes. Most of the time they want to move to the homes because they don't want to deal with facility challenges. But we can get creative with facility challenges because ultimately, safe place is a big deal. Parents taking their kids to somebody else's house or finding a babysitter will be the obstacle to keep the homes from happening. Happens really well when you're single and you don't have kids, or when you're newly married and don't have kids. But after that stage, it goes away. Okay, or if they're going to go to the home, they're only going to go to a home that they're really close friends with, which creates a closed group. And we don't want closed groups. So the church automatically, by offering the facilities, creates babysitting, but it's not babysitting, it's teaching. And so that's the very best place for this to occur. Now, the D groups, high accountability, deeper study, 3 to 6, same gender, D groups. Where? Doesn't really matter. Because they're going to be a closed group. They can meet at a coffee shop, they can meet at home, meet wherever, and it works perfectly. They can even meet at church, doesn't matter. They're going to be together for a while. The last one gets a little harder to read in here, but it says interest in topics, books, life needs, or pain points. You have couples who go, Pastor, I can't budget my money. Well, let's do Financial Peace University or some other budgeting technique in here, okay? Or maybe there's addictions and you want to provide how to get free from addictions or any other pain point. Well, at that point, there are people of needs, that's the who, and we would call that a small group elective. Now, if they have pain points, the where, Because they do have pain points, they don't care where they meet. They just want the answer. So they want to come together, and anywhere works. And it could be coffee shop, it could be church. Now, I would recommend in this case, if you meet at church, that it's not a Wednesday night and it's not a Sunday night. Because this can be a great form of outreach for you if you meet pain points in your community. Okay? You could offer computer classes, sign language classes. You could offer anything in this area and let them bump into Christ. Okay? Now, ultimately, the goal is right where the arrow is pointing. The individual disciple, which means we have that daily engagement with God's Word, daily time in prayer. Anywhere we find our quiet place for personal devotion and quiet time. Guys, ladies, if our people aren't having this, what we're doing is not success, it's disguised failure. And our ultimate goal is to cultivate mature disciple makers. That's probably the simplest goal of definition of discipleship we can have, cultivating mature disciple makers, okay? Now, let me give you this really quick. If we were in a multiple session, I would walk you through the four basic family models, okay, of generational discipleship. And by the way, I'll tell you what they are, but I can't walk you through them for time's sake. I'm only going to walk you through the D6 and show you why it should be foundational. One is integrated. That's where we collapse all the age group classes, bring everybody together, and you never have a youth group, you never have a children's church, you never have broken out Sunday school classes, everybody learns in one big room. There are some advantages to that. I don't advocate it, but I do advocate us doing more together than what we're doing separate right now, okay? But the second one is milestones. That's where you celebrate key events in a child's life, going to school, birth, baptism, finding Christ, getting a cell phone, purity, driver's license, graduation. But here's the key. Most people misinterpret milestones. It's not the celebration. It's helping the parents prepare before that milestone hits and modeling right behavior and biblical worldviews before that cell phone is ever given. So we don't have to triage what they're doing on their cell phones after the fact. Okay? The third one that we have is... Let me come back to this one. I'm going through them in order. Milestones, integration, is the adoption model. And this is where older, warm, nurturing adults lean into kids that may not biologically be their own. Okay? There's so many stories we can have. Teachers do that. Students do that. But the D6 model is where I want to talk for just a moment. We have siloed our ministries. And what we're trying to do is say youth ministry is important. Children's ministry is important. But they need to not look like that weird one-eared Mickey Mouse or Mickey Mouse with too many ears. They really need to function together and be part of big church and have some overlap where seniors are speaking into teens and teens are talking to the kids and children and these whole ages. So we're removing the silos with overlap, not integration, while maintaining age-specific ministries. That way we have worship, life groups, D groups, midweek electives, all feeding into daily life, feeding back into worship, doing what we're supposed to be doing. I hope this kind of gives you an overview. These are the five questions that we really have to answer and struggle with. But remember the one big takeaway. Know why you're doing it before you inform your what you're doing. Don't pick a program. There's not a program in a box that's going to solve your needs in 90 days or a year. It's going to take following these principles for a generation for us to change where we are.